synchronization defibrillator, CRT-D product. The CRT-D is a significant product for the treatment of heart failure, and Guidant was first to market in the United States with the new technology. The company faced not only losing sales to a competitor whose device was larger and used a less technologically advanced method of therapy delivery, but failing on its promise to customers to provide them with leading products to treat their patients with heart failure. Despite the fact that product development cycles typically take months, if not years, Guidant CRM senior management charged the product engineering group to take accountability for quickly bringing another device to market to support patients and customers relying on Guidant technology. Historically, product development did not take place in the product engineering group, so the thought process used to execute the project was slightly different than on a traditional R&D team. This device would be designed using a different platform to get around manufacturing issues, which had almost stopped production of the company's current CRT-D. A small group of cross-functional decision-makers met on June 10, 2002, with ground rules set. 1 hour, one meeting, come out with a concept. With no time to waste, the team produced an approved concept document the next day, and the clock started ticking. The product had an impossible timeline. FDA submission was scheduled for August, and no resources assigned to support it. Kent Fox, project manager for the Contact CD2, as the project was now called, put out a call to dedicated team managers throughout the research and development organization, asking them to give up critical talent. The loss of key personnel put other project deadlines at risk, but Fox was able to secure a high level of ownership for the Contact CD2 CRT-D's success and staff the project quickly with the right skill set to achieve the objectives. In the midst of this crisis, the company could have easily dropped below the line, hiding from the problem and its consequences, and waited for the next scheduled product launch. After all, Guidant CRM had never put out a product on such an aggressive timeline before. Why shouldn't the company just sit tight and hope that customers and patients could hold on until the next product, scheduled for a February launch? Instead, senior management opted for an above-the-line approach, an approach that they felt would enable Guidant to really remain a leader in providing heart failure technology to customers and patients. They charged a group to solve it, moving from finger-pointing, paralysis, and confusion to a level of organizational accountability that allowed the entire organization to own the company's circumstances. The team worked tirelessly to do it, with Fox reminding them that each day was equivalent to about 3% of the total project timeline. They were able to leverage existing hardware and software and even added a high-energy model, an industry first in the United States. The resulting Contact CD2 was 38% smaller than the competitor's device and filled a crucial gap in the company's product offerings. The team not only met the deadline for FDA submission, but also managed to exceed it by a week. From the development of the concept to FDA approval took 4.5 months. Under normal circumstances, the FDA approval time alone is 6 months. The product was submitted to the FDA, and thanks to the thorough groundwork in place, a track record of above-the-line dealings with the agency, and the FDA's understanding of the critical nature of this product for customers, it was approved quickly. Guidant launched the device in December and immediately received a positive reception, providing life-saving therapy to patients. This warm reception helped set the stage for the successful launch in February of the company's state-of-the-art CRT-D product, a product that had been in development for several years. Without question, the Contact CD2 project represented a difficult episode in Guidant's recent history. But to the credit of senior management and all the people who work at Guidant, they never wavered in their commitment to stay above the line. Undoubtedly, there were doubts and tensions along the way. Guidant could have easily wasted time, energy, and resources denying the problem, deflecting blame to the component supplier, and defending the status quo. But Guidant did what many organizations failed to do. It overcame the gravitational pull of the victim cycle and rose resolutely from solving it to doing it, despite the associated risks. Guidant's actions paid off, not only in terms of satisfied customers and healthy sales, but as a new paradigm for the development of inch-up products. In 2003, one entire product line was upgraded to include the Fast Change feature developed during this project. This feature is highly valued by many of Guidant's physician customers and has contributed to market share gain. Since this project, the new inch-up development strategy has successfully brought other products to market in rapid succession. In addition, the new safeguards were put in place to prevent future dependence on a single source for critical components. The organization had learned that getting the right result, regardless of the challenge to the product development map, comes only when everyone takes ownership of the company's reputation as a leader. The entire company will face the future with greater confidence in the product development process and with a strengthened corporate culture driven first and foremost by a sense of complete accountability. We also witnessed the benefits of exercising the means to do it when we observed a young business school graduate we will call Terry. Just out of graduate school with a shiny new MBA, Terry was interviewed by the director of development of a mid-sized company for a position in product development. During the interviews, the director told Terry that his experience in graduate school was exactly what the company was looking for. In fact, he promised that if Terry came on board, he would lead a product development team with all the budget and time they would need to get the job done. Needless to say, Terry enthusiastically accepted the job with a great deal of confidence. He knew from interviews with people in the company that he possessed skills and knowledge far beyond anyone else in the organization. Events unfolded precisely as the director had suggested they would. Upon beginning work, Terry received a budget, a timeline, a project team, and all the freedom in the world to make decisions and put his knowledge to work. Although a keen ear might have heard some mumbling among the troops about why someone just out of school deserves such an opportunity, the director loudly expressed his confidence in Terry's ability to pull it off. Over the next few months, Terry's team worked feverishly at developing the product. They found that co-locating, moving people from different functional areas in the company out of their respective departments and into the same working area, helped them focus and not get distracted by other daily issues facing the company. It was all going quite nicely, with Terry feeling fully empowered, even to the point that when people, including the president of the company, would ask him how it was going, he would respond, "Wait until you see what we're developing. It's everything you wanted and more." To reach a key milestone set by the director, the team worked around the clock. They would even take turns sleeping on the couch in one of the conference rooms. Never had the individuals on the team worked so hard and with so much enthusiasm. Each of them believed that that was what the company expected. As time passed, the need for the new product had become increasingly apparent, and everyone anxiously awaited its unveiling. When the morning of the deadline came, the team stood ready to unveil its work. Having worked the previous 2 days straight, members of the team felt exhausted, but their enthusiasm and excitement about making the date and completing the project with an even better-than-expected outcome filled them with energy. They met with the director of development in his office. It was a busy morning, and the director was working with fierce concentration at his desk when the team entered his office. He looked up at the clock and asked what they needed. They eagerly replied that they had finished the project and had written a presentation full of impressive information. To the team's surprise and to Terry's utter frustration, the director looked down and said, "Thank you. I will get to it as soon as I can. Do you need anything else?" Stunned, the team, confused by the director's response, marched dejectedly out of his office. Quickly, the confusion turned to frustration and then anger. Making matters even worse, the director uttered not another word about the project in the following days. A week later, Terry asked the director what he thought of the work he and his team had done. The director replied that he had not found the time to review the material because he had misplaced it. He needed another copy. Terry could not believe his ears. Utterly dismayed, he went back to the team and told them what had happened. Their outrage quickly turned to mutiny. People began talking about updating their resumes and looking for better jobs. Terry himself felt he had been had, that he was a completely legitimate victim, but he hesitated telling other people the story. Who would believe it? However, it did not take long for word to get around the company that the director was displeased with the efforts of Terry and his team. Terry could not remember receiving such unfair treatment in his entire life. What's more, others in the company seemed to swallow what the director and others were saying, hook, line, and sinker. As with many MBAs fresh out of school, Terry began considering his options, talking to classmates about opportunities in their organizations, and trying to get a feeling for the current job market. That's when a friend gave Terry a copy of the Oz Principle, and he began thinking about the situation in a different light. If he walked away a victim, could he ever hold his head high again? Wisely, Terry resolved to move above the line. As Terry took the see it step, he began talking to others in the company about what had happened. As he asked for candid feedback, he learned something interesting. First, he discovered that the company was on the verge of collapse as a result of the failure of some other product introductions. His team, having focused solely on their development efforts, remained blissfully unaware of the severity of the situation. Smack in the middle of all the turmoil, the director of development, who remained responsible not only for the problem but also for coming up with a solution, had put Terry's project at the bottom of the list, something that surprised Terry because he had assumed the team's efforts would capture the attention of the company. After all, his team considered the project central to the company's future. Everyone in development was working night and day on solving the urgent product problems, but Terry, having kept himself and his team fairly insulated, had never fully comprehended the magnitude of the company's difficulties. To make matters worse, the day Terry's team made the presentation, he heard the rumor top management had given his boss, the director, 6 months to turn things around or else. The director had just bought a large new home near corporate headquarters, so the prospect of huge mortgage payments and losing his job had certainly been worrying him. Further, Terry heard from more than one person that many in the department actually resented his team for not sharing their work or asking for input. People disliked that secretiveness, especially in light of the department's long history of teamwork. After absorbing all the feedback, Terry regretted what he had done. Somehow he had managed to alienate the entire department, which explained why no one expressed any sympathy for him or the team, and why no one even questioned the unsubstantiated opinions of the director. While Terry saw that the director could have helped the team better understand what they should have done differently, he also accepted the fact that he and his team had been insular and short-sighted. Perhaps he wasn't such a total victim after all. As he moved to the own it step, Terry began to recount more fully in his mind all the things he could have done differently, understanding the teamwork culture of the department, creating open communication with his peers, asking for feedback as he went along, and paying more attention to what else was happening in the department and in the company. As Terry came to realize that maybe he shared some accountability in all this too, he came to feel more strongly that he wanted to stay and make things better. After meeting with his team and talking through his new insights, he was pleased to find that everyone could easily list things they could have done to produce a better outcome. Solutions began to appear on the horizon. As Terry moved to the solve-it mode, he resolved to prove to the department that he was a team player interested in more than just his own success. He knew this would take some time. It would also take courage for him to sit down with the director and discuss what had happened and what he had learned from the experience. As he considered his circumstances, Terry knew that he had climbed above the line by taking the see it, own it, and solve it steps to accountability. While the feedback and perceptions of other people had made him uncomfortable and equally difficult to acknowledge, he took solace from the fact that although he had helped create this situation, he really could change how people felt about him and what he had to offer. All that awaited him now was to do it, the fourth and final step to accountability. Aware of the big difference between knowing what to do and actually doing it, he steeled his will to accept the risks involved in taking action. And act he did. Having moved fully above the line, Terry took decisive steps to alter the way people viewed him. He grew along the way. By taking an accountable look at his experience, he was able to overcome the forces that might otherwise have dragged him below the line where he could keep feeling like a victim of his circumstances. Over time, Terry brought his new product knowledge and innovative ideas into proper focus and became an integral part of the larger team. Eventually, he became director of development, a job he loves. These days, he spends many an hour coaching new employees to see it, own it, solve it, and most vitally, do it. Preparing to apply accountability throughout your organization. In the end, Dorothy exercised the means to do it. Only when she recognized and utilized the skills she possessed all along could she cement her own accountability for her circumstances and for the result she wanted. With newfound determination, she finally clicked her heels and returned to Kansas. While Dorothy had worn the magic slippers throughout her journey, she had not tapped their power until she had learned the Oz principle. People hold inside themselves the power to rise above their circumstances and get the results they want. Accountable people have grasped this principle for centuries. For instance, the Bible stated over 2,000 years ago in Ezra 10 verse 4, "Arise, for this matter belongeth unto thee. Be of good courage and do it." W. E. Henley, the English poet, characterized it another way. During one of the most trying periods of his life, having lost his left leg to tuberculosis of the bone and now fighting to save his right leg at the Royal Infirmary, he composed what has become one of his most famous poems, Invictus. "Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms the horrors of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how strait the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul." Back home in Kansas, Dorothy would never be the same because she had learned, through her arduous journey, that she was the master of her own fate. Breathlessly, she told her family and friends about the marvelous things she had experienced and learned in the land of Oz, a sharing you can now commence yourself as you apply the Oz principle throughout your organization. The subject of Part 3. Part 3. Results through collective accountability. Helping your organization perform above the line. Getting your entire organization above the line requires every employee to accept both individual and joint accountability for results. The process of doing so demands effective above-the-line leadership. In Part 3, we draw upon a decade of experience working with the Oz Principle to show you how to incorporate it into your own leadership, install it in your own organization, and apply it to today's toughest business and management issues. In the end, we think you'll agree with us. Accountability for results rests at the core of every business success. Chapter 8, The Good Witch Glinda, Mastering Above-the-Line Leadership. Dorothy then gave her the golden cap, and the witch said to the scarecrow, "What will you do when Dorothy has left us?" "I will return to the Emerald City," he replied, "for Oz has made me its ruler, and the people like me. The only thing that worries me is how to cross the Hill of the Hammerheads. By means of the golden cap I shall command the winged monkeys to carry you to the gates of the Emerald City," said Glinda, "for it would be a shame to deprive the people of so wonderful a ruler." "Am I really wonderful?" asked the Scarecrow. "You are unusual," replied Glinda. The Wizard of Oz, L. Frank Baum. Once the four characters from Oz completed their journey above the line, they finally found the strength, wisdom, courage, and heart to help others get there as well. In their case, the Good Witch Glinda mentored the traveling companions, watching over them and helping them get on the right road to personal ownership, accountability, and results. Like any good leader, she did not do all the work. Rather, she pointed the group in the right direction and coached them along the way. With the right intervention at the right time, she stimulated the travelers to tap their resourcefulness, heart, courage, and wisdom that eventually propelled them safely to the land of Oz and ultimately home. Leading above the line. So far, we've described how you can personally get above the line. Now we'd like to discuss how you can help others discover the secret of the Oz Principle, moving themselves above the line and get the results they want. Above the line leaders display a number of personal characteristics. While they may themselves fall below the line on occasion, they don't stay there for long. They actively seek and provide feedback. They hold themselves to the same accountability standard as everyone else, and they desire to help others follow their lead. Organizations today demand the best from their leaders. You can't just hit the numbers anymore. You must do it ethically, honestly, and in a manner that proves your concern for everyone around you. In a survey of 726 corporate directors conducted by Korn Ferry, the international executive recruiting and organizational consulting firm, respondents indicated that they would be more likely to remove a chief executive officer for leadership flaws than for poor financial returns. This increasing emphasis on effective leadership at the top has been reinforced by the power shift taking place in most organizations, in which senior executives seek to spread decision-making authority more widely to the lowest levels of the enterprise. As a result, above-the-line leadership will increasingly become a requirement, not merely an advantage, for most organizations. In this chapter, we want to share with you the experience we have gained over the last decade helping people become effective above-the-line leaders. First, of course, you must feel motivated to become such a leader. Assuming you have experienced the power and freedom that comes from rising above the line, you must now decide whether or not you genuinely want to help others accomplish the same. If you want to browbeat them with your newfound knowledge, compete against them with your superior accountability, control them for your own personal gain, or ridicule their below-the-line behavior, then this chapter will not interest you. If, on the other hand, you want to help others escape their below-the-line patterns of behavior, then you can gain great benefits from it. Recognizing when it's time to intervene. First and foremost, above-the-line leaders recognize when other people get stuck below the line, failing to obtain the results they want. By this point, you should have developed an increasing ability to identify below-the-line attitudes and behavior in yourself and others, and you should have come to appreciate how people can concoct elaborate explanations for everything that happens. Such victim stories, which can be quite convincing, make it difficult to discern the right time for intervention. Media mogul Rupert Murdoch has long been praised, criticized, lampooned, and emulated for his unorthodox business strategies and practices. Worth over $7 billion himself, he has shaped his company News Corp into the most admired, most stable, and most profitable media giant on the planet. How does he do it? For one thing, he never accepts victim stories. Fortune magazine describes him as the media titan who built his global empire of TV networks, newspapers, magazines, books, and movies by defying convention and taking risks. He gained a reputation as a gambler whose next move could never be anticipated, a pirate who played by his own rules, and an owner who cared little about short-term results. In reality, it appears that Murdoch has simply learned the art of above-the-line leadership, seizing opportunities and getting results no matter what the circumstances. When a situation demands a conservative and cautious approach, he chooses that option. When it requires aggressive risk-taking, he does that. As a leader, Murdoch never lets himself or his management team stay below the line for long. He recently referred to himself as a CEO who runs a very conservative ship at the moment, keeping our heads down, running the businesses. But now he's beginning to take bold action again because he sees a shift in the balance of power taking place in the industry, away from programmers and toward gatekeepers such as Comcast and Time Warner, assuming they can avoid bankruptcy. That's why Murdoch wants to acquire a satellite platform such as DirecTV or EchoStar. According to Fortune, with a satellite platform, Murdoch would have a weapon to protect his prized array of fast-growing cable networks, which include Fox News, Fox Sports, National Geographic, and the Speed Channel, which carries motorsports. The way the game is played, big cable operators won't give News Corp too tough a time about carrying its networks if they know that Murdoch controls distribution they want for their own programming services. Clearly, Rupert Murdoch never stops asking, what else can we do to get the results we want? No other questions will more consistently keep an organization above the line. Above-the-line leaders risk their own comfort and security by going beyond symptoms to the core problems that spring from a lack of accountability. When they see below-the-line behavior, they rip away the disguises worn by self-proclaimed victims to reveal the underlying reality. Unwilling to let themselves or others be fooled by the masks people fashion to hide the reality of a situation, they drive relentlessly to determine the real reasons why people aren't achieving results. Not even the most elaborate and creative victim stories fool them into thinking that if someone else would just do the right thing, all would be well in the world. They understand that symptomatic cures continue to hide and even exacerbate the problem, not solve it. They do not fall prey to the excessive activity syndromes. They blow away the smokescreen of programmatic solutions offered by organizational special interest groups, desiring to mask their lack of results. They dismiss the chorus of voices trying to convince them that if only we did this or that, everything would be fine. They understand that changes in structures and systems often only bury the real problems, problems they relentlessly work to uncover and solve. When above-the-line leaders hear about a particular problem, such as a lack of product quality, they don't bemoan that fact, but immediately try to figure out exactly how people at all levels of the organization, including themselves, have failed to shoulder responsibility for the quality of their own individual contributions. Such leaders know that whenever results fail to materialize, they must sweep away the curtain of excuses and finger-pointing to reveal the real reason why people are operating below the line. When they detect below-the-line behavior, they begin coaching people out of the victim cycle, a process we will explore later in this chapter. By recognizing when it's time to intervene and helping others to rise above the victim cycle, above-the-line leaders can help people focus on the right issues in the right way. Then, and only then, can the group and the organization begin creating a better future. Learning not to take accountability to the extreme. A word of caution. Like anything else in life, you can take your desire to seek out below-the-line behavior too far, turning an asset into a liability. Any virtue or strength taken to an extreme can eventually become a vice that actually gets in the way of achieving the performance and results you desire. One leader likened such an over-preoccupation to persistently pounding on a single piano key to the irritation and dismay of everyone present. In such a situation, the leader's effectiveness diminishes, and he or she loses the benefit and strength that comes from calling upon a broad range of resources, skills, and solutions. If you define everything that happens as an accountability problem, you may fail to see the complete picture. However, if you fail to discern the accountability factor in every problem, you will also make a mistake. Skillful intervention requires a delicate yet decided touch. Over the years, we have watched people take accountability to an extreme as they tried to force people to accept accountability for anything and everything that occurs in their lives. This may sound outlandish, but such extremists go so far as to argue that if a pedestrian walking down the sidewalk gets killed by a runaway car, the pedestrian can only blame herself because she chose to walk down that street at that particular time instead of taking an alternate route. That's ridiculous. Nevertheless, we could argue that the pedestrian or the pedestrian survivors will not get their lives back unless they accept responsibility for moving beyond the accident to a better future. Additionally, some people go so far as to blame a person's illness on a lack of accountability when it comes to working out the emotional issues and stresses of life. While a certain level of physical illness may result from pent-up anxieties or unresolved issues, you make a big and potentially harmful mistake if you believe that all illness, tragedy, misfortune, and calamity occur as a result of something a person did or did not do. The Oz principle teaches that people's circumstances result not just from what they do or did, although a person should always identify how his or her action or inaction has contributed to current circumstances, but also from variables they clearly can't control. Rather than continuing to suffer as victims of circumstance, people who practice the Oz principle know how to overcome such circumstances and achieve the results they desire. Even in the most extreme cases where people have been severely victimized, such individuals can take accountability for how they allow a traumatic experience to affect the rest of their lives. People can also take accountability to the extreme by trying to control other people. Operating like self-appointed thought police, controllers try to force others above the line into a world they themselves have created to suit their own beliefs and prejudices. A memorable Time magazine cover story labeled such overzealous extremists as busybodies. No one can or should try to force another person to be more effective, more righteous, more knowledgeable, more productive, friendlier, braver, more trustworthy, or in any other way more politically or socially correct. Coach them, encourage them, teach them, give them feedback, admonish them, love them, and lead them, but don't try to coerce them. In Time's article, author John Elson tells the story of a Los Angeles security guard who was fired for being overweight. Jesse Mercado was dismissed from his job as a security guard at the Los Angeles Times despite an excellent performance record. No one should be removed from or refused a job because they violate some whimsical, unprincipled standard of correctness. In Mercado's case, the courts upheld that view. Overweight Mercado sued, won, and got a judgment of more than $500,000, plus a return to his old post. Recognizing that you cannot control everything. Wise above-the-line leaders apply a delicate touch in those situations where things lie completely or partially beyond their control, both in life and at work. Such situations occur all the time, caused by such events as severe weather, natural disasters, other people's choices, fluctuations in the global economy, physical limitations, a competitor's moves, accidents, and government intervention. And, of course, no one can control such functions as family, birth circumstances, inherited traits, and physical makeup. However, too many leaders today do worry about things over which they can exercise little control, as discussed in a Wall Street Journal survey of chief executive officers, who revealed what keeps them up at night. The top five vote-getters in the worry survey receive more than 50% of the votes: employees, the economy, competition, the political environment, and government regulation. Wise leaders will separate those factors that remain beyond their control from those they can do something about. For example, since you cannot control nationwide economic conditions, why devote a lot of time to complaining about the economy? That will only squander your time and effort. Instead, you might spend your time developing strategies for addressing a variety of economic scenarios, an investment that might pay off handsomely. Try to identify all the uncontrollable issues you face, separating them from controllable ones. This way you can avoid falling below the line, complaining or worrying about what you cannot affect. The separation also helps you resist trying to rise too zealously above the line in an attempt to refashion everything and everyone to your own liking. Write down a few of the uncontrollables that currently receive too much of your attention at work or at home. Try to confine your list to characteristics, traits, situations, and events that are largely uncontrollable. Indicate the degree of control you have over the item listed by assigning to each item a zero, no control, plus, little to no influence, or double plus, some control. Creating such a list will help you isolate those aspects of your work and personal life that you can tackle effectively. As you ponder your list, consider how much time and energy you might save if you stopped getting stuck below the line, worrying about what you cannot change. At one of our accountability training workshops, a woman told the group about her experience as a young girl listening to her father recount his workday at the dinner table. With great emotion, her father would often describe all the day's ills with particular emphasis on the miscarriages of justice that had been wrought against him. While the family ate, he bombarded his wife and children with tales of his boss treating him unfairly. His boss was always coming off as a completely unappreciative, unfeeling, and unrighteous man. As dessert arrived, everyone tried to make the father feel better by confirming his perceptions and agreeing that he had been dealt a bad hand. These expressions of sympathy and support helped the family progress to other nightly activities. Looking back, the woman realized that her mother and the rest of the family had not done her father any great favor by accepting his below-the-line complaints, nor had they done themselves any favors. Her father's unhappiness and the resultant disruption in the family reinforced the notion that you can't alter what happens in life. You can only complain about it. Ironically, many studies have indicated that people cannot control over 90% of the things they worry about. That's a lot of misplaced worry. Imagine what additional good might have come into the life of the woman in our training session had her family's dinner discussions focused on what family members, including the father, could do to overcome whatever bad things happened to them. Correctly understood and properly applied, accountability empowers people with a new sense of control and influence over their circumstances so they can achieve the results they desire. Basically, helping people get above the line involves assisting them to see it, own it, solve it, and do it, in spite of all the variables in life they can't control. Providing a model for others. If you hope to create accountability in your own organization, you must also provide a model others can emulate. You yourself must remain accountable for the consequences that flow from all your decisions and actions. If you offer a negative model, you will more than likely take not only yourself, but the entire organization below the line. For example, in a Wall Street Journal article entitled, "Bosses Who Deflect Blame Put Employees in a Tough Spot," Joanne Lublin discusses one such negative role model, a boss who blames his or her personal blunders on subordinates. Lublin states, "Of all problem bosses, a blamer is among the toughest to handle. Limiting damage from misplaced blame requires delicate judgments, sharp bureaucratic instincts, and varying levels of risk tolerance. It's no wonder that many people end up doing nothing more than grinding their teeth." We have worked with thousands of individuals who would rate a boss who deflects blame as the worst boss in the world. Bosses who lead from below the line may enjoy some short-term gains, but in the long run, their behavior will only destroy the trust, cooperation, and focus needed to maximize results. Such a model of leadership will ultimately give people permission to fall into a deliberate cover-your-tail mode. As Lublin observes, a paper trail can also vindicate an unfairly accused subordinate, especially if the mistake comes up later during a performance appraisal. Dr. Grothy, a Boston psychologist, proposes that you give yourself an account of an incident and verify its date by sending yourself a certified letter and keeping the envelope sealed. It's a little form of self-protection, he says. What a waste of time, resources, and energy. How much better would it be for all concerned if the boss, first and foremost, put a stop to the blame game and concentrated instead on correcting the mistake or its consequences? Successful above-the-line leaders model accountability for everyone within their sphere of influence, remaining accountable for everything they say and do that shapes the model. If a leader knows when to intervene and when to hold back, he or she will avoid particularly ugly situations in which others chafe under the leader's incessant follow-up on their activities in a misguided effort to make sure they're honoring their commitment to accountability. In such cases, the leader has forgotten to adhere to a well-tempered model of accountability. Such behavior will often undermine people's confidence and sometimes even infuriate them. Again, good leadership demands a decided yet delicate touch. Of all the books written about Jack Welch, including Jack, Welch's own autobiographical account of his tenure as CEO of General Electric, we found Noel Tishy and Stratford Sherman's Control Your Destiny or Someone Else Will the most enlightening. This book reveals how Jack Welch really transformed General Electric. It struck a chord with us because its core message promoted accountability. The remarkable story of GE's transformation teaches lessons essential for the well-being of managers and layperson alike. Control Your Destiny is more than a useful business idea. For every individual, corporation, and nation, it is the essence of responsibility and the most basic requirement for success. As the world endlessly changes, so must we. The greatest power we have is the ability to envision our own fate and to change ourselves. That's above-the-line leadership. Welch set empowering his people as his overriding goal with the values of self-confidence, candor, and an unflinching willingness to face reality even when it's painful. Was it a cakewalk? Not at all. Here's how he himself described the difficulties. "I've made my share of mistakes, plenty of them, but my biggest mistake by far was not moving faster. Pulling off an old Band-Aid one hair at a time hurts a lot more than a sudden yank. Of course, you want to avoid breaking things or stretching the organization too far, but generally, human nature holds you back. You want to be liked, to be thought of as reasonable, so you don't move as fast as you should. Besides hurting more, it costs you competitiveness." He goes on to admit that he could have done most everything in half the time. When you're running an institution like this, you're always scared at first. You're afraid you'll break it. People don't think about leaders this way, but it's true. Everyone who's running something goes home at night and wrestles with the same fear. Am I going to be the one who blows this place up? In retrospect, I was too cautious and too timid. Effective leaders like the legendary Jack Welch strive to keep themselves and their organizations climbing the steps to accountability, applying a delicate and yet determined touch whenever they or others momentarily fall below the line. The following list identifies ways in which you can apply the right touch in your organization. Constantly ask yourself the question, what else can I do to achieve the result you desire? always urge your people to ask the same question, what else can I do? Invite people to give you feedback on whether or not they perceive you operating above the line on a particular issue. Provide honest yet encouraging feedback to others when they drop below the line. Actively observe activities and offer coaching rather than wait for others to report on their progress on any given project or assignment. Never delay reporting progress to your own superiors. And focus your discussions on things that you and others can control and do rather than on the uncontrollables. Acknowledge when you fall below the line and do not react defensively when others give you feedback. Once you master these traits and personally exhibit and model above-the-line behavior yourself, you can begin successfully coaching others to do likewise. Coaching people above the line. The process of inspiring accountability in others takes time. It doesn't happen as a result of some singular event. Many leaders mistakenly think that once they have exposed their people to the concept of accountability and gotten them to understand it, no one will ever fall below the line again. This event approach to accountability, the notion that accountability happens at an identifiable moment, makes no sense to us. Leaders who make this mistake often use accountability as a hammer, nailing people when they fall below the line in an unending game of I gotcha. Such hammering will only propel people back into the victim cycle. Therefore, you must help people feel empowered by the concept of accountability, not trapped by it. While you don't want to let the victim stories and behaviors go unchecked, you must bear in mind that the process of coaching people above the line requires patience, nurturing, and appropriate follow-up. Remember that people you want to help climb the steps to accountability have developed ingrained perspectives and personalities they cannot quickly discard or consider from a new viewpoint, especially if they feel cornered by an ever-vigilant big brother. Too heavy a hand tends to make people feel excluded from the process. I'm right, you're wrong. While a firm, delicate touch helps people feel included in the process. We've got a problem. Let's figure out how to solve it. A friend of ours, Jim, recently told us how betrayed he felt over a particular experience earlier in his career. Working as an accountant in a well-known regional accounting firm in Boston, he began looking, as so often happens in successful accounting firms, for opportunities to move over to the controllership of one of his firm's client organizations. Before long, an opportunity for just such a career move arose with a company he greatly respected. Eagerly, he started the interviewing process with the chief financial officer who was leaving the company, and then he continued interviewing with the new CFO, who would be joining the company from the outside in a few months. The interviews went well, and Jim landed the job. Excited about his new responsibilities as controller of a $35 million company, he relished the initial autonomy he enjoyed. He was actually running the financial side of the house by himself while he awaited the arrival of the new CFO. Jim felt good about his future. The sky was the limit. As Jim dug into his new job by thoroughly reviewing the company's financial statements, he discovered that a great deal of work lay ahead, especially with all the poorly organized financial statements he had found. When he approached Bob, the outgoing CFO, with a few questions concerning the statements, Bob dismissed his concerns with a wave of his hand, saying Jim's questions could wait until next week. "Hey, this is no big problem," he said. "Take some time to get into the swing of things." The next Monday, Bob met with Jim again, quickly reviewing the company's books and asking Jim to sign his final check. Since the check only amounted to a few $1,000s, and given his tenure as CFO, Jim didn't think twice about signing the check and wishing Bob well. To his alarm, as he dug further into the records over the next week, he found that Bob had persuaded three other people to sign his last paycheck. With continued scrutiny of the books over the next couple of months, Jim uncovered evidence that Bob had embezzled over $1 million through phony purchase requisitions. As he gathered evidence of the former CFO's wrongdoing, Jim shared it with the new CFO, Steve, who had begun coming into the office one day a week while wrapping up his job with his former employer. Steve asked him to keep the situation to himself and not even share it with the president of the company until they had constructed an airtight case. Jim worked many 14-hour days and weekends trying to unravel the scheme and amass the necessary evidence against the former CFO and his collaborators. When the president of the company stopped by one morning to speak with Jim, he casually mentioned that he suspected his former CFO of embezzlement, but still couldn't believe the man could have actually done it. To Jim's utter disbelief, the president praised Steve, the new CFO, for uncovering the mess and wondered why Jim had not seen it himself. Pointing an accusing finger at his new controller, he said, "You have been here 3 months, Jim. Why in the world didn't you find any of this?" Shocked by the revelation that Steve had taken credit for all his hard work, he vowed he would never trust another superior. Does Jim's story sound familiar? Many people in organizations have found themselves victimized by someone in authority over them. As an above-the-line leader, you cannot assume that the people over whom you exercise responsibility will automatically trust your coaching effort to get them above the line. Instead, your people may suspect you of harboring ulterior motives, particularly if you have participated with them in preparing victim stories in the past, or if you've not previously established feedback as a pattern of communication in your relationship with them. Keep this in mind the next time you attempt to coach someone above the line. Whenever you hear a victim story or a below-the-line excuse, try using the following 5 steps to coach that person away from reacting and toward learning. 1. Listen. Remain alert for instances of victim behavior, and when you engage someone in a discussion of their victim story for the purpose of coaching them, or hear below-the-line excuses, listen sympathetically to what they have to say. 2. Acknowledge. Accept the victim facts and genuine obstacles that someone thinks have kept them from getting desired results. Show the person that you understand his feelings and know yourself how hard it is to overcome them. Agree that the challenges are real or that bad things do happen to good people. 3. Ask. If someone seems deeply attached to a victim story or a below-the-line excuse, gently edge the discussion toward the accountable version of the story. Continually pose the question, "What else can you do to achieve the result you desire or overcome the circumstance that plagues you?" 4. Coach. Use the steps to accountability to help a person identify where she currently stands and where that person needs to go to obtain desired results. Take a few minutes to explain the Oz principle, using this specific instance as an example, but also share an incident where you yourself got stuck below the line. Emphasize that it's only natural to fall below the line on occasion, but staying there never yields results. Stress how rising above the line will produce positive outcomes. Walk through the see it, own it, solve it, and do it steps. Then adapt each of the steps to accountability to this particular situation. And 5, commit. Dedicate yourself to helping a person create an above-the-line action plan and encourage him to report on his activities and progress. Don't end a coaching session without setting a specific time for follow-up, allowing sufficient time, but not too much time, to elapse. If the person does not approach you at the appointed time, take the initiative yourself. During these follow-up sessions, continue to look, listen, acknowledge, ask, coach, and recommit. Provide honest, caring feedback about progress and express congratulations for every improvement. Once you begin coaching others above the line, you will quickly see the value of a person's accounting for her progress. Accounting for progress. In an ideal world, it wouldn't be necessary for leaders to coach accountability because everyone would acknowledge his accountability in every situation. However, since this is not an ideal world and since everyone is fallible, leaders must make coaching a daily habit. And while we have emphasized proactive coaching, which focuses on the present and the future, we've also come to appreciate the need to review the past, which we call accounting for progress. When handled properly, an after-the-fact accounting can provide a person with an opportunity to measure progress toward results, learn from previous experience, establish a sense of accomplishment, and determine what else she can do to get the desired results. While most leaders intuitively know the value of urging people to account for their actions, many often fail to do it well. Too many leaders wait for their people to do the right thing. Rather than asking for regular reports, they let them go, hoping that people will automatically measure their own progress. Avoid unpleasant confrontation that might possibly result from an unacceptable report. They may fear that such a confrontation will damage their relationships with people. Allow skeletons to remain in the closet, rather than dragging them out and squarely facing troublesome issues that have gotten in the way of results. they assume that people simply cannot surmount some issues and therefore choose to ignore them. Tolerate excuses as true representations of reality when they know in their hearts that those excuses prevent people from accepting the true reality of a situation. They allow this to happen in the hope that the problem will simply fix itself over time. Let their other responsibilities consume all their time. They don't make regular accounting a top priority. They simply wait for the results to speak for themselves. Fail to convince people of the importance of reporting on progress. Their own low priority becomes their people's low priority. Insufficiently clarify their expectations or inadequately explain the purpose of accounting. They accept vague reports because they've set vague goals. Do not set a specific reporting timetable or schedule. They let people decide when and how they will account for progress. Fail to use accounting sessions to coach individuals toward desired outcomes. They simply applaud or criticize progress. And do not understand that holding people accountable need not be a negative, hand-wringing, knuckle-crunching, head-bashing, life-threatening experience for those involved. They make sessions so painful that people come to dread them. If you can overcome these common mistakes, you will obtain the tremendous benefits of giving people the opportunity to account for their progress, which includes pinpointing what else people can do to achieve desired results, disseminating vital information people can use to break down barriers to results, identifying legitimate needs for the organization, and helping people look forward to their accounting sessions as a positive personal and organizational experience. Above-the-line leaders both give and require above-the-line accounting. Note the differences between effective accounting and accounting that falls below the line. From below-the-line people, report only when asked to do so. Justify or explain their activities. Run and hide when it's time to report. Blame others for lack of results. And react offensively to suggestions for improvement. From above-the-line people, report regularly and thoroughly. Analyze their activities in an effort to determine what more they can do to get results. Stand and deliver when it's time to report. Own their circumstances and welcome feedback. If you account for progress from below the line, you give permission for everyone else in the organization to do likewise. But if you invariably account for your own progress from above the line, the organization will follow suit. Leading from above the line. To help our clients master the art of accountable leadership, we have constructed a checklist that covers the most important do's and don'ts of above-the-line leadership behavior. Reviewing this list periodically should help you maintain a good model for your people. With effective above-the-line leadership skills, you can begin moving your entire organization to higher levels of accountability. Before you move on, however, take a moment to consider how long Dorothy and her companions took to come to the realization that they possessed the power within themselves to accomplish what they wanted. Glinda wisely provided the right kind of coaching and assistance throughout the journey. As an above-the-line leader, you should apply your leadership in ways that will help people and groups in your organization make progress. Serving as a model, recognizing when to intervene and when to step back, focusing on the controllables, coaching people above the line, and accounting for progress make anyone a better above-the-line leader.